Welcome to WISO Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenney. Today on the program, Miami Valley StoryCorps and Politics Ohio with Emily McCord. You'll also hear from Juliette Fromholt. She'll report on groups of women around the country who sing at the bedsides of people who are sick or dying. Don't miss that report. But up first, coming up next week, Dayton's Muse Machine will introduce audiences to their annual production. This year, they're headed into the woods. Into the Woods is a Tony Award-winning musical and a Stephen Sondheim production that pulls together many familiar fairy tale characters, but with a twist. This week I spoke with some of the show's cast and crew who were very excited with the production.
We didn't know what to expect when we announced this. Into the Woods might have gone either way, and what we found was that there's an enormous reaction. This show is very dear to people's lives, and I think that there are a lot of young people who knew this show and were so over the top about getting their teeth into it.
Doug Merck is the show's producer. He says the marriage of this musical and Muse Machine is the result of a long courtship.
It's been more than 10 years that we've been considering Into the Woods, looking at it, putting it on the table, and ultimately going one direction or another. And it's been for a number of reasons, because Into the Woods doesn't normally have dance in it, and we felt like we needed that. And there were a number of things that we thought, I'm not sure if this fits a Muse audience in one way or another. And so we've tweaked it and fiddled with it and took notes on it year after year and had compiled notes. And eventually this year when we pulled it out, we thought, we know how to make this one dance. Into the Woods was born from a book by Bettelheim called The Uses of Enchantment, and the nutshell of that is the idea that fairy tales have a use because when we are very little and we hear about fairy tales and what happens there, they plant seeds in us so that later in life when things occur, things like betrayal and death and very adult things, that's not the first time we will have experienced it, that we will actually have experienced it in some way through these fairy tales when they were young, and so it will prepare us. And the way this show takes that on is that there's a first act where we see these fairy tales we're familiar with, intertwined, and we seem to come to a happy ending, but then the story continues. And it starts to become something that's very real to all of us. We start to see very modern-day, contemporary problems. There's a lot of happiness. There's an awful lot of humor in this, just like real life. But there are a lot of things that we can't control, things that we don't always get explanations for. And it takes things that may have begun as a fairy tale, and it sort of thrusts it into the faces of the audience members. Again, it's always funny, and it's always fun, but it's very thought-provoking.
This is the final night for rehearsals at the Metropolitan Arts Complex, where Muse makes its home. Then the production moves next door to the Victoria Theater. The first person I spoke with that night was Anastasia Martemian. She's 17, and she's from Russia.
I started to dance when I was 3, and I went to music school when I was 5, so I have a lot of experience with stages. I've never been in the theater, though.
4 months ago, Anastasia came to study at Stivers School for the Arts. Then, in October, she auditioned for Muse. She plays violin in the orchestra. She loves what she's doing and says this is a great experience.
When I just came here, everybody was like, wow, you're from Russia. We're so glad to have you here. Everybody was so friendly, and I felt like in the family, it was so warm.
No talking. We're starting. Are we all ready?
As rehearsal gets underway, more than 60 cast and crew members flood the practice stage. There's a lot of energy in the room, and the students are focused on singing their lines and hitting their marks. They're having a good time. So was I. The kids finish one of their big musical numbers, and so comes my chance to talk with some of the cast. Samantha Eastman is 17 and a senior at Tippecanoe High School. Here's how she introduced herself.
I like to smile.
Samantha is all smiles, but in Into the Woods, she plays a witch. A witch named Samantha. That sounds familiar. Well, the role of the witch is familiar to this young actress. It's one she's played before, and she loves it.
She was cursed with ugliness, and she's just absolutely ticked about it, so she'll do anything she can to get pretty. And so she sets out on this journey, and she causes chaos within this small village that they all live in.
Playing an ugly witch is quite a stretch for a girl who looks like Samantha, but she says she's got it covered.
My dad tells me I have an ugly side, so I think I'll be able to do that. But I think there will be a little bit of makeup involved. But for me, it's about taking this journey and finding out who you are. And it's really done a lot for me, not only as an actress, but as a person.
Micah Trout is a senior at Beaver Creek High School, and he plays the baker, who he describes as quirky, insecure, and trying to prove to his wife that he's strong, though inside he's scared. Micah can relate to that.
It really relates to me personally, because I have my quirks and stuff like that, but I think he's one of the most, human characters along with his wife. I think they definitely have the qualities that, more people can relate to, I think.
Trout is 17 and loves singing. That's good, because he's good at it.
No more giants waging war. Can't we just pursue our lives with our children and our wives till that happier day arrives? How do you ignore?
The song that I sing is kind of one of the turning points for my character. I really, I decide to not, run away from things when things get bad. I decide to take responsibility and be the man that I should be.
The reverses. All the wondering what even worse is still in store. All the children, all the giants, no more.
Micah Trout says the baker and his wife are two of the more real characters in the play. The baker's wife is played by Mary Kate O'Neill, who says she wants to do musical theater for the rest of her life.
I started doing plays in first and second grade, and actually I went more into sports during middle school, and then I kind of rediscovered my love for it in eighth grade or so, and I've been doing musicals at my school since freshman year, and I started doing Muse Machine my sophomore year for me and my girl.
O'Neill says her character was hard to relate to at first.
I definitely had a problem with her when I first started the role because she is so human and she makes mistakes that I found hard to forgive. So it was really hard. It was really interesting going through her journey and being able to understand her. And I hope that what I do in the role is something that the audience will be able to understand her and kind of look back at their own mistakes and be able to work them out the way she does. I mean, and the thing is that you find out that even though you thought that you were so different from the character, there's actually so many things that you relate to in the character. I mean, I definitely don't live in a magical forest and I don't have witches and princes and princesses surrounding me, but it's such a real show.
This year's program is directed by Rufus Bonds Jr., who says rehearsals are going well and having so much talent to work with makes it easy.
And it makes it even more easier when you have young adults who are willing to listen. And to willing to dialogue with you with things that work for them and don't work for them, and you figure it out together.
Talent and communication may be key, but Muse Machine's productions don't get anywhere without hard work.
It's a fairly, and I want to ask you three about this as well, it's a fairly regimented schedule. It can be pretty tough if you're not ready for it, correct?
Yeah. When we left for winter break, is that what you call it, for Christmas? I went home and slept for 2 days. I was so tired, I didn't know what to do. But you come in, you're here every day, 4:30, 8:30 during the week, 1 to 6 on Saturday, 1 to 5. Is that right? No, 10 to 6 on Saturday, 1 to 5 on Sunday. And what's interesting about it is they're happy to be here. As they were speaking, I remember when I was in a place where you did the work because you love doing the work, and then you get paid. And then it becomes something else, but it doesn't become something else until you, unless you're not doing something you still love, meaning picking the right pieces to do as well. Because if you still love what you're doing on the stage, it will always be that much fun. It will always be playland.
And do you guys want to add to that?
Well, the schedule, you know, our rehearsals are long, but I sit in school and say, I cannot wait for rehearsal because, like, my best friends are here and I'm doing what I love. And getting to spend, you know, 4 hours after school doing what I love is just, I couldn't ask for any better.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people, you know, are concerned about, like, their schoolwork and their, you know, other activities that they do. But I always, you know, make sure I find time for that. I think there's always time at rehearsal. If you're not doing something, you can bring out your homework or something like that. And there's always time, you know, after rehearsal. But honestly, like, I wouldn't trade these hours at rehearsal for anything else.
I remember trying to explain to kids at school because they're like, you seriously have 4 hours of rehearsal a night and then you have to do your homework. And isn't that killing you? And I'm like, well, if it is, it's like, what a way to go. Like, it's just the best place there is.
Great. And are you all ready for the performance?
Ready to do it, but we wouldn't mind some more rehearsal. I'm pumped.
Ready. Yeah. I think we're ready. I'm going to be nervous, but I think nervous is always good because it shows that you really care about what you're doing. So
I don't think I've ever been this excited. Like, I sit in class and it's just like, oh, whoa, like, T-minus 1 week. Here we go.
We've been counting down the days until the performance.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for speaking with me. I really appreciate it, and good luck with the show.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
It's obvious that the young cast and crew energizing this year's Muse Machine love what they're doing, and all of them say they're making lifelong friends in the process. Dayton's Muse Machine takes you into the woods this Thursday, January 13th at the Victoria Theater with shows running all weekend. Learn more about Muse performances and showtimes at musemachine.com. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend.
Patricia Adams is a legal assistant from Gahanna, Ohio. She came to StoryCorps to share stories about work. Patricia's son, Brian, came all the way from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts to interview his mother. He wanted to hear about all the jobs she had before she took her favorite one, mom.
We want to talk a little bit today about work. What are some of your earliest memories as a kid of your parents working?
My dad would never call in sick. He often did not take vacation. My mother never missed work. It was just something that you didn't do. Now, it's careers and self-actualization and fulfillment. And I grew up in an environment where it was work and money and support yourself. And so for me personally, I babysat at a really young age. Made 50 cents an hour. That was the going rate for babysitters back then. Got my first job. My mom worked at Sears, and she got me an interview. And I worked in the credit department, which was a pretty good job for a 16-year-old.
What was your favorite memory of working in the credit department at Sears, or least favorite memory?
It was different back then. I remember a couple of things, one of which this will make you roll your eyes. I was one of the youngest people to work there. And one day I was wearing this bright yellow dress and white, like, go-go boots. And the guy who was the head of the whole, it was called Credit Central, came up to me, and it scared me because he almost never came out of his office. And he came up to me, and he was real tall. He came up to me, and he said, "Ms. Adams, if you keep dressing like that, I'm going to have to charge an entertainment tax to the people who work here." You couldn't say that now.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that horrible? But that does stick with me as a memory.
So this would be like around 1969, 1970.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was like, you know, 16 or 17. Yeah. And I can remember blushing. But he was a very nice man, and I don't think he meant it in a lascivious way, I think.
It was like a compliment?
I think he was complimenting me. And in those days, that would have been complimentary. Right. Hmm. But my other strong memory of that work is leaving on Christmas Eve with the phones ringing off the wall. Mm. And the supervisor would say, "That's it, we're not answering anymore." So you looked at all, there was just a huge bank, probably 100 phones that we would pick up and answer. And you walked away realizing those people who waited till the last minute, you know, just wasn't going to happen.
We're going to get their Christmas gifts.
Right.
Do you think that impacts your current ability to plan very far ahead for Christmas?
No. I've forgotten that.
Yeah, they fixed that system. All right, so how long did you work at the credit department?
Till I went to college, and then I worked summers when I came back from college. Next in my working history was taught driving in Cleveland until we moved to Columbus so that Daddy could go to law school. They made me the manager of the office that they had in Columbus at the time.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So then 1977, you have me. Mm-hmm. So what was the decision like to, you know, not go back to the driving school?
I had planned to go back to the driving school because, you know, I was like really the only person in the office. Most everybody was like out on the road. And I thought, I'll just take this child and put him in a little, you know, baby bed, and he'll just lay there and I can do my work. And then we had you.
That wasn't how it worked out?
No. And you cried and fussed and carried on, and you were way more work than I was prepared for. It didn't feel like a choice. It just felt like I really couldn't.
Well, I think so. This has been really fun, and I do. This is a good time to say that I really do appreciate that your job for most of my childhood was paying attention to me and giving me different stimulus, not putting me in the playpen. So thanks. So thank you for being the stay-at-home mom, and thank you for coming to StoryCorps.
Thanks for having me.
Patricia Adams and her son Brian at StoryCorps in Dayton, Ohio. Their conversation was edited by Sevilla Mann. It will be archived in the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress and on the WYSO website at wyso.org.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Around the country, there are groups of women who sing at the bedsides of people who are sick or dying. It's called Threshold Singing, and there are choirs all over the United States, including one in Yellow Springs. WYSO's Juliet Fromholt has the story.
The idea for the Threshold Choir was born in 1990 when Kate Munger was caring for a friend who was dying of AIDS in California. After spending the morning doing practical things like doing the dishes and cleaning house, Munger sat down at her friend's bedside, unsure of what to do next. So she began to sing.
I sang to myself to combat my nervousness, and I watched as I was singing. I calmed down, he calmed down, and at the end of the afternoon, we were both completely serene, and I felt like I'd given him something that was deeply important from me. It was a gift of my essence, a gift of my soul to his soul.
A few years later, Munger invited a group of women to become the first Threshold Choir. A threshold choir can be any size, but usually only two or three women sing at a bedside. They huddle close to each other and to the patient.
With her own hands,
to recreate the sound of a lullaby sung to a baby. So we're singing quite softly. We're snuggled up very close.
Because the goal is for the women to blend their voices, even in larger rehearsals.
To sing together with your friends, either in circle at rehearsals or in twos or threes at the bedside, to blend our voices in this service is so bonding. It's a fantastic addition to my life.
Teresa Horen Sapinar sang with a threshold choir in Northern California before she came to Yellow Springs. Now she's the director of the Yellow Springs Choir, and says this is a great community for a threshold choir.
Because we have such a small, interwoven community, we're involved in each other's lives in many different ways. So to come together to sing in this really sacred service that we all want to give to the community and to each other, I mean, we sing for each other, and we sing for our relatives and our friends, fathers, and nieces, and so it has a very special quality to it. We also sing to people that we've never met. I mean, that's true, too, but it often happens that we have some connection to the people we sing for.
Horen Sapinar says that in addition to singing with her choir, she also looks forward to helping develop new songs as a group.
The women in this choir have so much depth and empowerment and musical love for what we're doing. And I'm sure we're going to have some wonderful songs come out of us.
The Yellow Springs Choir has grown to 35 members. This fall, it hosted a regional gathering of Threshold Choir members and directors. Since then, several new choirs have formed in Ohio and the surrounding states. Kate Munger predicts an increase in the need for Threshold Choirs and similar groups as baby boomers age.
We've changed everything we've encountered. You know, we changed how babies were born. We brought back home deliveries. We've changed the way our culture is eating, and here we are looking at our own death and imagining it very different than it's been for the last 100 years.
For WYSO, I'm Juliet Frumholdt.
You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, Emily McCord with Politics Ohio.
You know the WYSO silent auction is February 12th, of course. Maybe you'll consider donating an item to be auctioned off. Maybe your business provides a service or a product. Maybe you're an artist, a writer, a musician. Maybe you have a timeshare in a warm climate. We rely on you to support us, and this is our biggest fundraising event of the year. If this public radio station is important to you, donate something to our silent auction. Call 769-1388 or go to WYSO.org. You have until February 4th. Thanks.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Today I'm speaking with Bill Cohen. He's a reporter for Ohio Public Radio. Thanks so much for being here.
Sure.
On Monday, John Kasich will be sworn into office as Ohio's next governor. This week, Kasich initially said that media would not be allowed at the official swearing-in ceremony, as well as some other inaugural events, and then reversed his decision later on in the week. So, Bill, what does this say about Kasich's approach to transparency while in office?
Well, he's said he's in favor of transparency, but then there are times when he comes down on the other side of the issue, and this was a good example. In the end, he has relented and said, yes, I will allow a few reporters into the 12:01 midnight swearing-in ceremony, and instead of it being at his house, it's now going to switch here to the State House. He also relented on something else in a way. Earlier, there was a transparency dispute because he'd asked people to submit resumes for top state jobs to him. And a reporter said, well, let's see them. And he said, well, I don't need to give them to you. But now he has said, well, once he becomes governor, he may have to put out those resumes because they will, his lawyers tell him that, yes, they will be official public documents and he will have to release them. So every once in a while there is a dispute. And I think some of the reporters and other folks who call themselves good government advocates, they worry a little bit that the new administration may try to shield some things from public view.
Let's talk about the state budget. What is the Ohio legislature's first step in approaching how to plug the deficit?
Well, you might think that the first step would have been over the last year, since they knew some kind of huge deficit was looming, $4 to $8 billion, or now some folks say it might be 10 or 12. You might think they would have done a lot of planning and held a lot of hearings and really kind of tried to prepare for this ahead of time. They did hold a few hearings, but they really didn't come out with specific recommendations that they could agree on. And so it really does fall to the incoming governor. And that's why John Kasich, the new governor, probably in March, will unveil his particular budget proposal. And then it'll go to the Ohio House, and the Ohio House can change it however it sees fit, although we don't expect majority Republicans there to do that many changes, since they tend to agree. Looks like they're going to be agreeing a lot with the basic thrust of the new governor. So it'll go to the House, and then the House will pass its version. It'll go over to the Senate. Republicans will be controlling both chambers, so they won't have to listen too much to what the Democrats say.
Do we have any inclination of who's facing the most severe possible budget cuts?
Well, I think a lot of folks figure it's going to be virtually across the board, that just about every part of state programs and interests are going to be cut. And that means perhaps schools, perhaps universities, Medicaid. Those are three big chunks of the state budget. Perhaps even corrections, prisons. They take up a big chunk of the budget, too. So even though some of these things used to be sacred cows in better economic times, I think just about everybody's expecting they may be ordered to trim spending even more.
Governor Kasich and Republicans have said they're also not planning on raising any taxes. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, that's right. They insist, and a lot of them ran on a campaign pledge that they would solve this huge budget hole without raising taxes, at least on the state level. Who knows? If they cut back a whole lot, we could see a lot of tax hikes or tax hike proposals on the local level. You know, schools coming to voters saying increase your local property taxes, cities saying increase the city income tax, libraries saying, hey, increase a tax because we've been cut back by the state. But in general, Republicans say we can do it. We'll just cut and we will also streamline government and put in efficiencies. Interestingly, though, even one of Kasich's major allies, the Chamber of Commerce, which helped elect him, they came out with a report recently and even they said, you know, we may have to have a couple of tax increases, at least plugging some tax loopholes, getting rid of some tax breaks, which a lot of people do call tax increases. So an interesting report from the Chamber of Commerce.
The inauguration ceremony is taking place on Monday. WYSO will be carrying it live beginning at noon. What can we expect from the ceremony itself?
Well, your ceremony is right. It's totally ceremonial. This is not like a State of the State address where we expect to hear some real policy proposals from the new governor. Usually this kind of speech is just kind of an inspirational speech, a yes, we can do it. We can dig ourselves out of this hole. Ohio can be great again. That's, I think, what we would expect to hear. I think quickly afterwards, the governor and the new legislators will be getting down to work. We even hear that a few hours after the inauguration ceremony, we may be seeing some executive orders from the new governor, John Kasich. So we'll be looking for that. That's on a much more substantive front.
Bill Cohen is a reporter with Ohio Public Radio. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield. If you missed any part of today's program, you can listen online at WYSO.org. Our Why So Weekend theme music was provided by Magnolia Bolthead. Coming up next, the Book Nook.